Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
All right, Cindy, it's the meat segment of the show.
Yay, here we go.
Now, there are a lot of times people will build menus based on an idea or a concept. Most cooks who really love to cook, they're like, you know what, I want to cook lamb, or I'm in the mood to cook filet mignon, or I'm going to impress people, I'm going to do venison that I got from this ranch or something like that. So for your impressive dinner party, what are you in the mood to cook?
Well, I love rabbit. There are two things I want to talk about. So rabbit is one. I think it would be nice for people to sort of do a timbale or a little bit of a molded course so they get to work in a slightly different way than they would maybe at home and impress someone. I don't know.
A timbale, molded course. What do you mean?
So we use ring molds. Cylinders at the restaurant for a lot of different things. And I made this course one time for Mr. Parker, and it's a great way to use the rabbit loin as well as the legs. I confit the legs, and you have two totally different textures with the loin and the leg, especially when you have the difference in the cooking procedures. So you have grilled and you have confit. And so with this timbale, you can have that confit made ahead of time, and that's going to go in the bottom of the ring mold. A little bit of saffron rice, and it could be saffron basmati rice. It could be a little bit of risotto if you wanted to make an herb risotto, maybe fresh rosemary risotto in the center, and then a little bit of wilted spinach. And if I hadn't already used mushrooms, I would probably put a little bit of nicely caramelized something fun. Again, it could be the hedgehogs, or it could be button mushrooms. It could be oyster mushrooms, but I actually almost prefer the button mushrooms for this use. And you just build up that ring mold with all these wonderful ingredients, and you do have to kind of pat it down a bit so that obviously it doesn't fall apart. But it's just a beautiful course. You see all these beautiful colors, and all these flavors go together perfectly. And then, I would suggest a reduction sauce with this, and you can certainly make stock from the rabbit carcass, and you would probably already want to have a chicken and veal stock reduction going. And you would just add the rabbit bones to that stock to make your sauce and reduce it down.
So it's a double stock.
It is a double stock, fortified stock, basically. Rabbit stock from chicken and veal. And, that's one way to go. And then another way would be a crown roast of pork, which to me is very old-fashioned. And it's kind of what we're talking about is food that's been done for many years. And, you want to go to your butcher for this and ask them for a crown roast of pork. And it does present really beautifully, because what you have is it's the loin and part of the rib. And it has the bones have been Frenched. So that means the bones are exposed and they're, I don't know how to say other than they're sticking up in the air, and the roast forms a circle. And one of the things that you could do is, as you're roasting that roast in the oven, you could put a force meat or almost like a stuffing in the center of that roast, which would give you an accompaniment that's already taken care of. So perhaps you would have ground pork and ground veal that you season with salt and pepper, a little bit of fresh thyme or fresh rosemary. You could even do some sort of spicy spice, such as you could put chili powder in there. You could put saffron in there. You could even put Tabasco in there. But add a little bit of breadcrumb to that force meat, maybe a little bit, like one egg for the whole force meat, just to bind it together a little bit and give it a little bit of richness and protein, and actually sit that in the center of the crown roast. And it's just a now you have your beautiful platter that you're going to present this crown roast on, and I would certainly take it back to the kitchen and portion it and then serve it from the kitchen on plated plates.
So you'd slice the pork from the, because it's standing up.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, like if you made the steeple with your fingers as a little kid.
Right.
the ribs of the pork are standing up and the meat is all down.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd roast that kind of thing. I mean, I'm assuming you'd marinate it, season it well,
mm-hmm.
and roast that medium well, somewhere
right.
To get flavor. Well, one other thing I was thinking about just when you were talking about this, going to your butcher maybe a week ahead and talking about sourcing on something. You're going to spend a piece of money on whatever that last protein or two is that you're going to be getting.
Yes.
Give someone a chance. Don't go to the store the day of or
no.
2 days ahead.
You have to give them.
Give a reliable butcher a good chance to get the things that are what you want, if you have specific needs, so you don't have to adapt something entirely. And so you also can get something with a little bit of lead time, and it's not just someone popping something out of a freezer, where the butcher's actually sourcing the product.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that, and the source for the pork. I mean, there's so many different kinds of pork you can source right now.
The different some heritage that are, breeds.
The heritage breeds, naturally raised things, Karabuda pork, which can be awesome.
Yes.
I mean, that's probably what I would, if you're talking about doing a forced meat or almost like a stuffing in the center of that crown roast, I'd be very tempted to use, you know, I would ask for the livers of the pork to to enrich that, and like livers and brioche and...
Or you could use chicken livers, too.
Well, I was going to say...
Might be fun to add another flavor.
Plums and you know, and something like that, and walnuts to that stuffing, and make it a very old-fashioned sort of, you know, you slice one slice of the pork, or two, three chops for a person, and you have a little bit of that stuffing on the plate. What do you think about, I mean, that's, and timing something like that out, that's purely, that's not a bad last course because it's not a lot of a la minute things. I mean,
right.
like the sweetbread, if you're grilling sweetbreads and you're sautéing morels, you're doing a dance back and forth to get those things right. And the sweetbreads will be fine and dandy on a serving platter and very easy to serve a French serve at a table with the morels, you know, just like the morels just laid across the sweetbreads. That's a pretty easy service thing. But you really do have to dance back and forth. With the crown roast of pork, I mean, what are you talking? You're talking about probably 45 minutes or something like that of oven time, a few moments of resting time, not too much.
Right.
And literally just take it back in the kitchen and plate everything.
Right. It's not a hard course to get out.
Are there other dishes, side dishes? People always think about, you know, are you missing a vegetable? Is there something else that's natural? What is the juxtaposition to the garnishes? Or people often think of the reason I threw prunes into the idea of the stuffing is people often think of fruit with pork, and they're pleased with that. And it's also that kind of informs what you're going to do wine-wise with it.
Well, you could have poached pears with it, as sort of a savory. Well, and talking about Bois Madeira, that would be a lovely, lovely...
Madeira poached pears.
Yeah, Madeira. Actually, I poached pears in Bois Madeira, saffron, and star anise, cinnamon stick, and clove the other day. And I've never poached pears that exact way before, and they were beautiful. That would be delicious with pork.
And not so sweet.
Just don't put any sugar in there. The Madeira is your sugar, basically, so you don't have to end your pears of, obviously, natural sugar content. By the way, pears don't ripen after they're picked, so be aware of that when you do pick out your pears. Even if you get them a week ahead, they're not going to get much better in your kitchen, so they just begin to deteriorate. That's what they begin to do, so...
So if you're doing a garnish that is as sweet as that, you got to think about that with the wines that you choose. That's actually probably your best excuse to some of the natural sucrosity of some of the West Coast wines. And pork is not, it's a funny thing because it's not always considered a red wine matching, you know, sort of a dish. If you do reduction sauce of some sort, if you have stock reduction that you finish with. Let's say you did it with prunes and with plums or something like that, and you did a reduction sauce that you finished with something that I would want something a little bit bitter or something a little bit strong in that sauce to juxtapose the flavor and kind of pull back a little bit of the sugar effect in the garnishes on the pork. One, and two, the wine, you need to have something that has not so much acid, decent but not overwhelming tannin and alcohol, but pretty good sense of sucrosity, and so people often will think, oh, well, that's, you know, I like Cabernet, you're saying West Coast wine, that's probably too tannic and a little bit too dense. There's good purchases available in West Coast Merlot, honestly, from Napa, and I would look at that. Bordeaux grapes from Washington State, I would look at Merlot specifically. Syrah from sites in Northern California, up the Sonoma Coast and into Mendocino, I would look at. In the south of France, probably the most natural thing, honestly, is look for a ripe vintage Châteauneuf-du-Pape. 2007, 2009, there are good purchases you can go back and get in 2009 because the 10 vintage has a bigger reputation. The 9s are faster maturing, and there are still some 9s in the market from good producers that might work for that kind of a dish. And that's a fun, crowd-pleasing sort of wine. And honestly, for the people that want to take wine into their cheese course, it's very easy. If they want to take red wine into their cheese course, if you're not serving some older contemplative wine or something, or you're not serving an interesting white wine or sweet wine with the cheese course, let's just get into that. With cheese courses, do you want to do a giant big tray of cheese? Do you want to pick out one or two things?
Yeah, I think one
something
or two,
very directed?
Because you've had a very, very serious meal, and you know, you want something to enjoy the last bit of wine with, and you want to kind of move on to that that wonderful, I don't know, I know it's not a refreshing course, but it's
well,
it is
that last savory, fatty, serious, like there's an intensity. The point of having cheese after that last meat course is that last step of intensity.
Yes.
It's more fat, more salt. So I mean, that makes me think blue cheese, that makes me think strong, mature goat's cheese, that makes me think some of the washed-rind cheeses that are stronger. And usually it's a wine that's not too dry that does best with those things.
Mm-hmm.
To make life easy, if you're doing the Crown Roast and you're drinking an 09 Chateauneuf du Pape, say Bosquet du Pape or something like that,
it'd be
very easy to go into a mature goat's cheese.
Okay.
Like Le Chevreau from Poitou or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Garrocha from Catalonia, same kind of thing.
Or Beanley Blue from England, that might be really beautiful.
Beanley Blue, to Ireland. Me, turns the corner.
Okay.
Turns the corner of wanting sweet wine. As the other thing that I would do in a second is do just warm baguette toast, like butter in a pan, sautéing slices of baguette,
mm-hmm.
served warm, with big fat wheel of or piece of Roquefort from the Languedoc. The salty, strong sheep's milk cheese, super satisfying. Serve cold sauterne with that. Very good, young, fruity cold sauterne. Not super mature stuff. Sauterne, the funny thing about sauterne is that there are lots of great vintages, especially in the last 10, 15 years. And they're honestly more fun to drink relatively early. Say the 05s, the 03s are great right now. Even the 7s are great right now. But they don't never really go up in price. If you actually want to go back at auction and buy something that's a lot older, the wines kind of live almost forever, almost like Madeira. If you wanted to have Madeira with cheese, then I would do firmer cheeses. And you're such a Stilton fan. That's something that older Boal Madeira, if you want to open a prized older bottle of Boal Madeira, that would be natural to have with
and that's
Stilton.
My favorite way to make toast points, what you were saying, sautéing them. And that's what I do.
That is
home.
Not the low-fat way.
That is exactly what I do. Yeah, sauté them in butter until they're golden brown on both sides.
You've had this ridiculous rich meal. Do you want a sweet?
Absolutely. Your palate needs it. I think you look forward to I think most people look forward to a sweet.
That last big balancing point of salt is the cheese.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the croquembouche. I'm thinking about a couple of different pastries, but the croquembouche is something that you can make ahead. And again, you have this amazing display because it looks like a Christmas
tree.
Do
you still sit at table for something like a croquembouche? Or
no.
Do you actually get up and like that's on display in the living room or
exactly.
something?
Exactly. Now you can retire to the living room, get up from the table as you say.
Croquembouche is this ridiculous thing. We need to post a photograph of the croquembouche on the Formal Wolf page on the WYPR website. It looks almost like a Christmas tree made out of sort of little golden pastries all strung together with sugar.
And it's filled with pastry cream, and you just pull each one off. It's basically profiteroles, if you've had those. It's again, we're getting back to choux paste or pâte à choux, which is what is used to make gougère and the beignets that we were talking about in the last show. And it's sweet, so you put a little bit of sugar in your dough, and you once they're baked, you fill them with the pastry cream, and then you build it into this tree. And that was something that this was used as a wedding cake in France. It was used in celebratory dinners.
The most fun way I've ever seen this is filled with a variety of different fillings.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah, you can have
like
chocolate
pastry cream. One is pistachio, one is chocolate.
Sure.
One is almond.
Raspberry, sure.
You know, one is orange.
Whatever flavors you like, coffee. And then
you're going to do all the work. You might as well build a little surprise into it, build a little fun into it.
That's,
you know, it's not just here are 60 pieces of profiterole exactly the same, but why not do three flavors or something and build it? And so you have to kind of shop your way through the croquembouche.
And you have that little bit of caramel that's holding the whole thing together, so you have that flavor as well.
With that, if you're standing there and it's relaxing time and it's sort of on the hoof and you have little plates and forks and you're spearing little pieces of the croquembouche, you just need a cold glass of champagne, not the driest stuff. You need demi-sec champagne. There are a bunch of houses that make good demi-sec champagne, but although honestly, if someone poured me a glass of Krug with that, it wouldn't upset me in the least.
That wouldn't upset me either. I think baked Alaska might be fun, too. You know, you have something that you flame, and of course, you want to be very careful if you're going to do something like that.
If you've had a wine along with the dinner that you're serving, I would be careful about serving a flaming dessert.
Okay.
So perhaps you don't catch your sparkly apron on fire.
Well, maybe if you weren't intoxicated, you could serve baked Alaska, which is ice cream with cake around it and meringue on top, formed into a shape, and you
and the pour flaming brandy.
The flaming brandy is pretty fun to
and
do.
And dance it through the room.
Yeah, exactly.
Watch out for
the curtains.
So the question is. Is there any spirit at that point? Is there any spirit that, after a rich meal like that, I always want some kind of, at least a small pour of some very functional for digestion, you know, spirit. If not a contemplative spirit with a cigar or something on the porch, but an eau de vie. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a giant thing. It can be an excellent grappa. And those are things that are not meant to be sipped and savored like cognac or armagnac. It's, or Poir Williams, something like that. Something that you take a couple of quick pum-pum sips of, and it makes a big difference in your digestion.
And also, it might wake you up after that meal. Your attention.
Well, definitely get your attention.
With the high alcohol.
Get your attention.
Content. That sounds good, though.
So, if you wanted to serve, like, the impressive dessert at the table, not get up from the table, what's the thing to do?
I think soufflé makes everyone happy and
isn't everyone
excited.
Scared of making souffle?
And I think they probably are, and it does take a little bit of practice, but really they're not that hard to make. And Julia Child has the absolute foolproof. Her Grand Marnier recipe is perfection. Just follow it, really. And Grand Marnier is one of my favorite souffles, and she also has a chocolate souffle recipe that is also perfect. So, and I typically serve that with a little bit of creme anglaise. I think you do need a little bit of a sauce, as you would open up the souffle for the guests with two spoons, or they would do it themselves and
pour
a little
bit of sauce.
Mm-hmm. So that would be a beautiful
individual souffles.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if it's a small dinner party, 4 or 6 people, it's a big one.
You could do a big one. Yeah, absolutely.
Just don't slam the oven. All the tricks of having it fail have to do with slamming the oven door or the wrong temperatures.
Right.
Or
you need a thermometer in your oven to make sure that your temperature is right.
And that's why you have to practice it.
Yeah, and don't bang anything on top of your stove either. So don't bang the door closed and don't dance on top of your stove either. It's not allowed while making souffle. Oh, and one time I was teaching someone I know how to make a souffle, and we had an earthquake while I was teaching them. Okay, so that's not
don't
good
have
for
an earthquake
souffle
while
either.
You're making a souffle. Perfect. Now, clearly, this is a dinner party that can go on for a long length of time.
Yeah, hopefully, hours and hours.
But if it's the one big one you do during the course of the year,
it's worth it.
You want to do the work. You want to get ready. Coming back on Foreman and Wolf, we have a producer segment with Chris Blandy from the superb Madeira House, Blandy's. He's the 7th generation winemaker, proprietor of the house.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a very cool story. All that and more when we come back on Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine.